have police photographing our license plates.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando, your host, and my guest today is Matt Gallagher. Now, Matt originally was asked to be on the show because of his actually in being in Bob and the Trees. You may have heard those interviews with the director, Diego, and with Bob himself. But actually, the more I looked into Matt, I'm fascinated with all the other things he does. But first of all, hello, Matt. How are you?
Hello. How are you? It's great to be here.
Thanks for being on the show and putting up for my head goal today. Well, first of all, tell us your connection with Bob, of Bob and the Trees. Let's start there.
Sure. I'm actually married to Bob's daughter, Emily. We met at a mutual friend's wedding about 10 or 11 years ago, and we've been together ever since, and we spent the better part of the last decade living in the Berkshires in Sandusfield, right near Emily's mom and dad, and we've just been, you know, we were helping them with both of their respective businesses, working on the farm a lot and working out in the woods shoulder to shoulder with Bob. For a lot of those years.
You know, I've got to tell you, although I had a similar thing happen in my life when I was in high school. It didn't end in marriage, but I, you know, I was a big city boy, and I met, I don't even remember how, I guess my parents were visiting relatives in the country, as we called it, but I met a young lady and became quite infatuated, and the only thing was her father wouldn't let her date me unless I came and worked on his tobacco farm. So... So for a few summers, I learned a lot about how to pick tobacco in all of its various stages. So I'm glad things worked out even better for you. We're going to talk about the movie and the making of Bob and the Trees, but I want to first get to you and this craft beer brewer. You're a craft beer brewer in New Hampshire. How did that happen, and what is that? I mean, I went online, I looked up stuff, and it, you know, the history of beer and prohibition and all that, and I'm going, well, gee, I need Matt to still tell me what that is.
Well, Emily and I were just kind of looking for sort of a change, a little bit of a move. I like being close to the, a little closer to the ocean. I'm a pretty avid surfer, so we looked back into my home state of New Hampshire and looked at that short, little magical 17 miles of sea coast that we have here in New Hampshire, and decided to just pick up sticks and make a big move and make a big change. It was great, you know, working on the farm and working out in the woods as I get into my, you know, as I was getting into my middle 30s, you know, logging was getting hard. It's really hard. It's really dangerous.
Yes.
And, you know, just looking for a change and something slightly more stable. So we moved here, and I had a chance encounter with the head brewer of the Portsmouth Brewery in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is New Hampshire's first brew pub. And after a nice conversation with him, he brought me on as his apprentice a few years ago, and was working, you know, side by side with him and learning a lot about the industry and about brewing. I was always a home brewer. My father was a home brewer. I had just never considered it as a profession. I always considered it a hobby. Lo and behold, I'm doing a hobby now for a living. My old head brewer, Tyler Jones, who brought me on, he last May opened his own brewery in Oxford, Connecticut, and I happened to slide up into his job. So I got my boss's job, and now I'm operating operating as the head brewer of the Porcelain Brewery. So lobbying to making beer. I tell you what, making beer is a lot safer.
Than lobbying, yes. I can imagine that. Well, tell me, you know, some of the things that make craft beer brewing different. I mean, it's smaller, more independent. What's different about craft beer?
I mean, craft beer is sort of a loose term, I would say, but it's, you know, any sort of small regional brewery that's making, you know, several different styles of beer, trying to stay somewhat true to the historical or the regional roots that that style of beer came from. And there's a big modern movement in craft beer right now. People are seeking out alternate styles than that classic American Pilsner most people have been having for the last, you know, several decades. It's just sort of a new movement, or not a new movement, but a revival of a once, you know, very popular movement of lots of different flavors going into beer, using lots of different varied ingredients, and kind of pushing the bar and seeing where you can take flavors to.
Wow.
And, you know, finding out that beer and food pairings, just like wine and food pairings are very popular, you know, to me, there's so many more flavors you can achieve with beer than you can with wine, and it's an ultimately much more pairable item with lots of different fruits, and so we have a lot of fun with that.
Well, tell me about that, because I must admit I've never been, except when visiting Europe, especially in Germany. I do drink the beer in Germany, no question, but dark, heavier, really fantastic. But generally speaking, summertime, it's a high-end vodka for me, and all the rest of the year, it's a red wine or Merlot or something of that sort, but I'm certainly not knowledgeable about American beer. So these flavors, I mean, flavors in beer, that's a new thing for me. Tell us about that. Different flavors.
I mean, you're essentially, the difference here between, you know, brewing beer and making wine is that I think a common saying is, you know, to make a really great wine, you need to have really great grapes, because that's your sole ingredient.
Yes.
Beer is consisting mainly of just four ingredients: water, malted grain, typically barley, yeast of some sort or some origin, and hops. Those are the four basic ingredients, but there are lots of different ranges of roasted grains that can create a lot of flavors, and you're not just limited to those four ingredients. I mean, people are putting cucumbers in their beer now, and oranges, and limes, and lemons, and cheesecake, and lots of fun stuff. And going back to making a good wine, you're needing good grapes.
Yes.
You know, to make a great beer, it takes a great brewer to bring all these ingredients into line and to make them all, you know, harmoniously fit into your palate and make it something that you want to drink.
Gotcha. And you pair the different flavors and different beers with different meals, as, you know, generally speaking, white wine with fish and fowl, and red wine with red meat and veal,
exactly.
Et cetera. Is New Hampshire a kind of beer brewing center?
It's slowly becoming one. There seems to be a real big push sweeping the nation. There's thousands of new breweries, small regional breweries popping up all over the country every year now. And New Hampshire's seacoast has definitely become a little bit of a hotspot. There's brewery tours, bus tours that people are booking now to the seacoast, where they have a designated driver, obviously driving the bus around, but they hop around from brewery to brewery and get to taste a bunch of different beers and meet a bunch of different brewers. And from, you know, my experience in the industry, brewers are quite characters, a lot of characters in the brewing industry, so it's just kind of fun to put a face to the flavor.
When I'm down in Charlottesville, Virginia, there are new breweries there that have caught on, and they actually have, just as what you were describing in Nelson County, which is a little further south and west of Charlottesville, they have this tour of all the wineries, and then you go from the winery itself for wine, but there are also beer tours and the new breweries, the smaller ones, and they seem to be cropping up everywhere. It's coming back if it ever went away. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we're almost back up to the amount of breweries we had in this country that we had before Prohibition.
Yeah, wow.
There were several thousand breweries here before Prohibition hit, and only a small percentage of them made it through Prohibition were able to start back up. And we've slowly been building those numbers back. back up, which is great because beer is a living thing. You know, there's living yeast inside it. It's a perishable item, and you know, a beer that is, you know, say made in California and thrown into a warehouse and then shipped across the country on a truck, bounced around, brought to another warehouse, then delivered to a local regional pub. You know, I just don't think that beer is going to taste as fresh and as quality as a beer that's made right in the area that you are. You know, when I travel, the first thing I do is try to seek out the local brew pub.
Yes.
And I want to taste the local flavor of their beer and what it tastes like, the way the brewer meant it to taste right off that tap.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. It's like food. If you grow it right there and you eat right off the land, it's obviously a lot fresher than going through the system. The system has become so, I won't go there, but it's so much happening in the system of transporting our food and drink that that can be disappointing. I hear you.
Yeah, I think the whole locavore movement with food has basically slid over into craft brewing. And because, you know, the ingredients we're working with are agricultural ingredients.
Yes.
You know, the grain and hops, those are both agricultural products. So why not, you know, drink fresh? If we're going to eat fresh and local, let's drink fresh and local too.
Okay, I'm for it. So what are hops? I hear people say that all the time. What are hops exactly?
Yeah, hops are a very beautiful aromatic flower that grows on a vine. And it grows each year. It spreads rhizomorphically, so through the roots in the ground. But these little flowers have a lot of resins in them that contain a whole lot of aromatics and flavor. And these aromatics and flavor, depending on the hop variety, can be ranging generally from like citrusy flavors and aromatics to earthy, spicy, peppery, you name it, sort of all over the flavor wheel. And so brewers trying to employ these different varieties of hops to achieve certain aromatics and flavors and bring balance to the beer, because these hops also bring a bittering quality when you put them into beer. And the malted barley you use is very cloyingly sweet.
Uh-huh.
And so to bring the beer into balance, you need to balance the sweetness with the bitterness of the hops. And when done well, it's a really beautiful end result.
Now, when you say done well, and I'm not trying to be funny, but this is a hands-on job, yes? You have to, there's a science to it. As you say, there's a balance, there's a creative design, if you will. It's not just a pinch of this and a pinch of that, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's very hands-on. It's a very involved process. You know, there's certain breweries that are highly mechanized, and they can probably brew from a computer in their living room if they wanted to. But my small brew pub is very hands-on. It's the same equipment that we've had since we started back in 91.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we are right there, you know, been monitoring it through the entire process from brew day through fermentation and through finishing. You know, you're right there with the steam in your face,
yes,
if you will, coming out of the kettle every day.
Wow.
It's quite an involved process.
Do you have connected to your brewery a place where people can come and actually sample or dine as well?
Yes. So there's sort of different classifications for breweries. Mine is a brew pub, so none of the beer we make actually gets distributed off the premise. So I make the beer. It all stays in-house. We have a full menu for lunch and dinner, and all of my beer never leaves the house. It's all just served right off the tap, and that's, you know, that's a great thing. And we're constantly with our, you know, I'm working with our head chef at the pub, coming up, you know, he's coming up with daily specials for the food menu, and I'm pairing what I think would be the best beer pairings with those food specials as a recommendation for any of our customers.
Fantastic. This is exciting. And you're right off the water, you say?
Here in New Hampshire, we have a very small little 15 to 17 mile coastline, but we're right in Portsmouth, which is sort of the border town. If you go over the Route 95 bridge from Portsmouth, you cross over and you are in Maine. After
Wow. So this is exciting, especially since it really didn't start out as what you thought you were doing. And I guess maybe it has the same hours, but it's certainly a different kind of work than being a forester, yes?
Yes, definitely. You know, every time in the winter when it's negative 20 out and it's snowing, I have a little smirk on my face while I'm nice and warm in my brewery and I'm not out in 2 feet of snow, you know, freezing my fingers and toes out.
Yes. Well, how did you get into surfing?
I got into surfing. I went to the University of New Hampshire, which is also here in the Seacoast, and, you know, just kind of dabbled around having fun in the ocean and, you know, borrowed a guy's board one time, really enjoyed myself. Spent several years after college out in San Luis Obispo, California, Central California coast, and explored a lot of that coast surfing and came back here to New Hampshire, eventually to the Berkshires, and you find some good waves on the East Coast. I was usually driving to Rhode Island or New Hampshire or Maine, and had a really thick wetsuit.
Yes.
Pretty warm.
you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's it. We don't get a lot of consistent waves here, but when we do get, you know, say a big nor'easter or during hurricane season, we do get some pretty good waves here on the New Hampshire coast, even though I don't want too many people to know that.
Yeah.
It's not that crowded yet. But.
Well, you know, you say you're not out in the 2 feet of snow working the logs, but you get a lot of snow up that way, don't you, at wintertime?
Oh, yes. Definitely tons of snow. I mean, we're not doing too bad right now. There's just a little dusting on the ground. We had a little bit of rain the other day, which took a bit of it. But, we can get bombed. We had a pretty solid winter last winter, as I think a lot of people are going to see in the film.
Yes.
Lots of snow out there.
Yes. Speaking of Bob and the Trees, getting back to that, but I just found as I read up on your information and looked into things, it was a subject that I was extremely interested in, what you're doing now and the craft beer, being a brewer. I know next to nothing about that. The more I studied it, you know, starting with the Native Americans and working my way up through Prohibition before it was time for me to go, okay, I need to ask an expert so I can get all of this. I'm just wondering, we're going to take a short break very soon, but connecting this segment with Bob and the Trees, the film, as you said earlier, you met Bob's daughter, Emily, and you worked a while with Bob, and we'll talk about all that in the next segment, but you've ended up now with Bob's daughter in New Hampshire crafting beer. And that's our guest today, Matt Gallagher. We're going to take a moment, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Matt Gallagher's role and involvement in Bob's life and in the film, Bob and the Trees. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. We were intrigued when we started hearing reports of an entirely original film that had those in the know talking. It had been seen at the 2014 issue of the Sundance Film Fest and was being described as the first Iranian vampire western. Interesting. A girl walks home alone at night. Turns out to be exactly the kind of film we love to feature here at the Indie Film Minute. Beautifully shot in luminous black and white by an emerging Iranian-American filmmaker. Its brilliant imagery hangs in our memory alongside the greatest of art. When the final credits roll, two thoughts dance through our heads. First, what a perfect ending. And second, we want more. A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is a love story between a striving young man and a female vampire. It is set in a world of decadence and disaffected youth with stratification of wealth and cruelty between the exploiters and exploited. A once flourishing mankind has brought itself into decline and devastation. Yet strength remains in the heart of the hopeful. And here, one of those hopeful souls just happens to be a vampire. Dark, but brilliantly effervescent. A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Find us on the web at IndieFilmMinute.com.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today is Matt Gallagher. Matt Gallagher is a craft beer brewer in New Hampshire. We are now going to talk about his role, literally, in Bob and the Trees. We've talked about Bob and the Trees before, beautiful western Massachusetts area, where Bob Terasuk was the star, actually playing himself in a sort of slice of life movie. And Matt, you were in that movie, and you played who?
I played actually a character named Matt.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't body as far as the character I was playing.
Uh-huh.
I did happen to be playing Bob's son in
yes.
the film and not his son-in-law.
Uh-huh.
So we were basically just portraying fictional characters that are sort of loosely based on our own characters and
yes.
our own experiences out in the woods.
Yes, and it was that too was revealing. That part of your life was quite revealing to me. I talked with Bob and Diego about the very limited experience I have with forestry involved just hearing about long after it happened. My grandmama being approached by the Commonwealth of Virginia to sell off her trees. She had quite an estate, and a large part of it was forest. She said she would sell it to the state, but the state had to plant new trees and then come back 30 years later and cut those trees and so on and so on. It was quite an interesting story, I always thought, in the family. And I asked Bob about it, and he said, yes, it made good sense to him. But he made the point that in Virginia, in the area, the trees were pretty much the same type of tree. And so you do things differently in Western Mass because you have a variety of tree types. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, you know, sort of our roles in real life in the woods is Bob is the forester, and he was the one working on behalf of the landowner, you know, going in and creating these management plans to not only improve the timber that they currently have, but also to generate a little bit of revenue.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a very replenishable natural resource we have here. So my role was more executing the plan that Bob was creating as a forester. So I was, you know, literally the one going in and cutting the trees that Bob had marked. So,
yes.
you know, that was sort of more his realm than mine. I was just sort of the practitioner of, you know, an executing plan, if you will.
Now, I was sort of trying to find it where Matt the person and Matt the character, the fictionalized version of Matt in the movie. You seem to play the role of Bob's reality check. Bob had sort of put himself out on a limb, no pun intended, and you were trying to get him to see the facts of life and pursue things a little more realistically. But in life, when it comes to forestry at least, is that sort of where you've flipped your roles there?
You know, not really. You know, I say that the characters are sort of loosely based on it, but all of the stories that take place in the film are all very creatively woven together by Courtney Diego and the writers of the films. It wasn't necessarily true to like the way we interact with each other
uh-huh.
in the film. It was more brought together to sort of create a good plot and a good story.
Uh-huh.
You know, what is truly realistic about the film is the hardships of
yes.
logging in New England in the wintertime. That is a very true element to the film. You know, everything else is quite fictionalized.
Okay.
You know, there's definitely a scene where Bob and I kind of have it out
yes.
a little bit. And, you know, I personally would never talk to my father-in-law the way I talk to him in the film. You know, Diego worked with us a lot in rehearsals
yes.
trying to develop our characters and kind of stay true to who we are, since Bob and I had never really had any acting experience.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, a story had been written, characters had been developed, and then Diego had to work really closely with the two of us to sort of become those characters while remaining true to ourselves.
Sure. It sounds like that would be a challenge under any circumstances. What did you think of Diego as a director?
I thought it was amazing. I mean, I was really just felt incredibly lucky to be a part of a project like this that I've never really been exposed to. It was incredible learning experience. I thought Diego had a lot of moving parts that he had to sort of keep control of, and also having to sort of hold the hand, if you will, of two non-professional actors, all in just really brutal weather, and you know, having to deal with all that. I thought he handled it well to keep a smile on his face with all of the stuff we had to go through last February. I definitely give a lot of credit to Diego.
I had that impression too from watching the film. You guys were out there in feet of snow, and in those conditions, not only making a film about forestry and the difference between forestry and being a logger, Bob straightened me out on that, but also that you're actually, this is what you guys were doing. I mean, you meet his daughter at a friend's wedding, and the next thing you know, you are working as a forester. How was how was that transition for you? I mean, how did that even fit into your plans? Or were you just in love and that's just the way it goes?
Well, I also grew up on a farm myself in central New Hampshire. It was a dairy farm. So I kind of had a similar background and upbringing that Emily had been brought up with, you know, with Bob. And so when Emily and I first met, we ended up moving out to California, as I had mentioned earlier. And after a few years out there, we kind of were interested in coming back and getting back into our farming roots. So we decided it would be a really nice thing to go move a little bit closer to Bob and Sue and help them out. They had, you know, a large farm, and it was kind of just the two of them. And so it wasn't too hard of a transition. I definitely learned a lot from Bob in the forestry world. You know, I was handy with a chainsaw, but I didn't really know the science to going in and sort of managing forests and things like that. So the transition wasn't too hard. It was really fun. Bob's a real character, as people are going to see when they watch the film. And I don't think many people can honestly say that their father-in-law is their best friend. And so I'm really lucky to be able to say that, because we definitely get along really well. We we work really well together. And we really enjoy ourselves a lot, too, when we're not working.
You know, and we get some of that in the film as well, and that is a great compliment to any in-law. I enjoyed my conversation with Bob, as I am now with you. He is a real character, but he both has a sense of humor. I guess you have to with the economy, and it hit everyone, and we had a great conversation about how that impacted, the economy impacted on the forestry business. But also, there's a great deal of family entertainment and friends around the dinner table, because that kind of communication is, I guess, what keeps the core together. There's a common goal and people working together. And I guess the director and writer, Diego Ungaro, saw that from what I see in the film and what you and Bob have told me, and wanted to put it on film so that people had some sense of what it was like to live this life. I don't think we've really had a realistic look at the life of a forester. I mean, there's a lot more to it. You don't just whip out the saw, as we see in the film. And as Bob told me, there's a lot of mathematics to it. And, you know, getting on the computer and figuring out, okay, where do we want this to land and how many do we need? And then after you do some of that, you find out the tree has infestation of some sort. And so you start all over again, and you're working for people who come to you who don't know as much about it and maybe not always as patient, but they want you to do something with their land, etc. It seems you're challenged from every end. And then also Bob had animals to deal with too, pig, sheep, a cow that is hurt in the film, and interesting way that mystery is resolved toward the end. I want to know about your reaction to being in the film and playing a fictionalized version, I should say, of yourself. How did you ever sort of meet yourself coming in and out of the door, or what?
I mean, it was definitely, like I said, a pretty interesting experience, and a lot of learning took place. You know, it was just kind of strange waking up every morning and having a production crew kind of over, you know, wardrobe and getting you mic'd up and all that. And it took a lot of time just sort of sensitizing myself to all that. And then also kind of being able to turn it off, because, you know, these days were really long, it was really cold, and you kind of, not that anyone was applying pressure, but you just kind of felt the pressure of, like, really wanting to get it right.
Yes.
So we could move on and get out of that cold, and, you know, the cameras are freezing and everybody's hungry and all this. And so, you know, we were, Bob and I think both, you know, I don't want to speak too much for Bob, but we were both kind of sinking into our characters quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And having to step back and at the end of the day and say, oh yeah, you know, I really wasn't that mad at Bob. You know, just waking up every morning and really trying to get you to wrap your head around all of the different, you know, emotions we were going to have to portray, because a lot of the, out of necessity, a lot of the movie was filmed out of sequence, so I was kind of having to jump in and out of different moods and things like that. So, you know, it was definitely a challenge. I have nothing but respect for an actor or an actress, you know, after going through this, just this one experience. It was pretty amazing.
I know what you mean. I am a director and an actor and writer and all that, and I can remember one of my earliest acting experiences was a scene from Funny Girl, and I was Nick Arnstein, and Fanny Bryce was a tremendous talent, and I had stepped into the role because of medical reasons for the leading man, and they had called me because in those days I looked like Omar Sharif. So they call me in, and we do this amazingly emotional scene. Her heart is ripping out. She's crying or whatever, and I'm, you know, because I'm leaving and all that, and then she's, the moment is finished, and the lights go out, and the audience is applauding, and then she taps me, okay, babe, let's get off the stage. I mean, I thought she was really, you know, really going through that because, by the way, she was going through a separation and divorce. And I thought, oh, my God, this is caught her. We're not going to get her back. Well, she was, the moment the lights were out, she was showing me the way off stage. I love it. It was just great. So I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, Bob literally, you know, there's a few heavy moments in this movie. I don't
yes.
want to give away too much. It's
yes.
very light, fun stuff. There's some heavy moments. And for a guy who moved out of Bridgeport, you know, 30 plus years ago and has been just farming and in the woods and never, you know, in the limelight.
Yes.
You know, he acted himself into legitimate tears a few times during the filming of this movie. You
yes.
know, the scenes were so heavy and he was having to, like, draw on these emotions and he pulled it right out of the depths, and it was really impressive to see him having to, like, take a few minutes for him to center himself again.
Sure.
To film the next scene. That was really, really amazing to see. I was super proud of him.
Yes, he was amazing. And it was just, as I said, it was just as amazing talking to him on the telephone for the interview. I don't know what I expected. I don't usually sit down and try and prejudge what a guest is going to be because, hey, you're going to have this time to chat with them. But he was such a convincing character and person at the same time when I saw the movie that I really was just anxious, curious, anxious in a good way. I was excited to hear what he was like on the phone. And he was hilariously funny. He was incredibly knowledgeable. And it was an exchange that just drew me in. And
he brings a passion to just about anything that is worth doing to him. You know, he definitely has a spark and a passion, and he brings it to the table all the time. So he's a great guy to just sit down and have a beer with.
Yes. To bring us full circle. Has he ever had any of the beer that you've brewed?
He has. He's sort of, I don't know if he wants me to tell people that, but he's developed a little bit of a gluten allergy. So he tries to limit the beer
yes.
that I make because it's glutinous maximus.
Well, my wife has me now going on gluten-free, and I'm lucky I don't miss beer because I was never quite a big beer drinker, but I certainly miss bread and potatoes and pasta, that's for sure.
Yeah.
How many years did you work with Bob?
It was just about the better part of it, the last decade.
Wow.
We just moved here about 3 years ago to New Hampshire, and so I think we moved to the farm right around 2003. So that whole time we were either living at the farm or living just, you know, half a mile down the road in a little house that we found eventually. So a good long time, and a huge bond was created.
I guess so. And it shows in the movie. As you say, you play his son in the movie, not his son-in-law, but the bond is obviously there, and that comes from real life. Acting is that. It has to have some root in the reality of life. Otherwise, it's not, you know, it's a photograph, not a movie. I didn't mean to offend photographers. Speaking of cinematography in this movie, my goodness, I told Diego, I was so impressed because he made Western Massachusetts and the area in which you and Bob were working and your neighborhood and community and the bar and the home, all of that was just sort of laid out before us, and yet somehow he managed the greatest feat that any film director can do. He made the camera disappear. That to me is so powerful. I love it when I direct, I tell people, you know, if someone comes up to me and says, a great directing this or directing. That's not as great a compliment as when they say they all seem to do everything just so naturally. And that's what we're after, that you forget about us over here on this side of the camera. And this movie, Bob and the Trees, has this quality. And I think a lot of that comes from your relationship with Bob and his with you and, of course, with Emily. So how does Sue fit into all of this? How is she, how does she, all this celebrity?
Oh, I think she's probably excited to have this whole Sundance thing come and go.
Yes.
Sure. Talking about it quite a bit to her, she's probably sick of it by now. But, you know, Sue was a huge help through the whole movie, just sort of obviously offering up her house and her farm to
yes.
all the production crew. And, you know,
and I know what that's like.
Traipsing around her place wherever we wanted to, and she always, you know, greeted us with a smile
yes.
And support. So that was really, really nice of Sue to do a lot of that for us.
It's,
I think she was glad for that whole thing to be over.
Yes. It is an invasion. I mean, once a film crew arrives, regardless of the size, it takes over, because that's the only way it can create the situation. I mean, the sound and lights, the cameras, the crew, you know, the grips, the director, the actors, you know, the writer on hand. Of course, Diego both wrote it so he could argue with himself. We didn't need an extra person for that, but still, it's quite an amazing thing. Well, tell us, we need to go. This has been fabulous. Matt Gallagher, craft beer brewer in New Hampshire. Tell us if we're up that way. How do we find you, or online, or come by and have a beer?
Yeah, definitely. If any of the listeners or yourself are passing through Portsmouth, New Hampshire, we're right at 56 Market Street in Market Square, downtown Portsmouth. You can also find lots of great information at portsmouthbrewery.com.
Excellent. All right. Well, we've been talking with Matt Gallagher, who is, as I said, in New Hampshire, brewing craft beer, but also part-time actor, and has worked for almost a decade with his father-in-law as a forester, and they are seen portraying themselves and as characters fictionalized in Bob and the Trees, which, by the way, if we haven't made clear, Robert Redford and the whole team at Sundance has asked Bob and the Trees to come be a part of the Sundance Film Festival, and that's no small accomplishment. So congratulations to you, Matt, and Bob, and Diego, and everyone. Okay?
And, oh, thank you so much.
And my best to Emily, too. Bye now.
Yeah, you got it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. You take care.
Yeah, bye.
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 Stay with us, as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. For those willing to venture toward the unknown, Todd Berger's It's a Disaster is a wonderfully obscure comedy, here to rescue the comedic adventurers from weak drivel and contrived laughs. Set at a couple's brunch gone awry, thanks to a surprise announcement of a divorce, Berger's script quickly ups the stakes with an off-screen terrorist attack that unleashes toxic gas into the atmosphere. After sealing up all the doors and windows, the four couples have no choice but to confront some serious issues in what may be the last few hours of their life. Berger's script, brought to life by the comedically charged cast, including the familiar faces of Julia Stiles, David Cross, and America Ferrera, is a knockout. The laughs don't stop from the moment we first see people on screen, and only get bigger once the looming threat of death by dirty bomb forces the characters to act in more and more irrational ways. Almost no one saw this one at the theater. A comedy with a terrorist attack is a risky bet. But It's a Disaster is a find, delightfully pitch black and filled with acerbic wit. Like your jokes rapid fire and as dark and jarring as a shot of espresso, dive right in. It's a Disaster. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Find us on the web at indiefilmminute.com.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. God give me guts is a famous D-Day prayer. Dare conservatives and liberals together honor D-Day 1944 and 2014 in giving innocent until proven guilty another shot?
Free will empowers us to emulate the greatest generation or be sovereign citizens with an open-carry domestic terrorist agenda, to be defined by convenience store owners cheating Florida's lottery players, or be like Flight 33 passengers and heroically save potential gun violence victims from Seattle to Atlanta in a single day. But do we have the D-Day guts to defend the rights of Americans who continually demand our constitutional rights while they distort the sacred honor of the nation-defining words written therein? And do we have the D-Day guts to reach out to true conservatives who are being discriminated against by Koch-funded governors that they themselves elected? Have we D-Day guts to be Republicans that make Eisenhower and Reagan proud by liberally defeating governors who are anti-teacher, anti-voter, anti-citizen in Wisconsin, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Ohio, Nevada, Kansas, Iowa, Arizona, and anti-renewables, cokeheads, anti-middle America legislatures? However, before redefining ourselves as America, the gem of the Eddie Slovak firing squads dispatching deserters as traitors, which, by the way, was condoned by General George Washington in 1781 to deter potential Federal Hill mutineers, let's acknowledge in our Civil War, though both North and South executed deserters, they usually waited until after a court-martial. D-Day 1944, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and General Dwight D. Eisenhower sent 150,000 of the greatest Allied generation to take back Europe from the Nazis. And on D-Day 2014, we celebrate that for 70 years, the French, despite the insulting old Europe Rumsfeld and ugly American arrogance of freedom fries, have returned to the Normandy American Cemetery to tearfully thank America and Americans for coming to thank Lafayette. Yet. We can transform support our troops into a cliche of political convenience to cover up an appalling lack of medical treatment for veterans, or we can support the bipartisan Veterans Affairs Reform Bill by ejecting a Congress that has supremely failed both American civilians and those who've served them in the military. We can choose to love thy neighbor as thyself, or closet our neighbors in brownback-stained states in favor of lower taxes for the wealthiest while enabling legislatures to disable Medicaid expansion for the neediest, and, on top of that, force legislative conversion on gay Texans. We can honor what veterans have fought, suffered, and died for, the sanctity of one person, one vote. Or we can host 2 a.m. tea parties behind closed courthouse doors and, like Executive Republican Chair, use Hinds County Sheriff to ignore the fact that campaign staff were left alone with private ballots cast by Mississippi voters. We can choose to take lives or choose to save lives, to protect votes or steal elections. We can choose to do better in this 2014 election than imitating Watergate and Jim Crow with photo ID abuses of Justice for All. And we can put bank executives' backs against the firing wall with legal investigation, indictment, and trial by jury. We can continue the second American concentration camp where legal counsel, trial by jury, parole, and judicial sentencing is outlawed, or risk being impeached for executing an end run around a do-nothing Congress of hypocrites to close a maleficent Guantanamo, a stain on America's fading reputation for human decency with conduct unbecoming. We can, as Lincoln's past, borrow and return habeas corpus, or we can be mushroom cloud gangbangers, stealing and preserving our habeas corpus for a growing police state. Yes, we can, like tornado-destroyed Greenburg, Kansas, rebuild with renewable wind towers, if only in 2014, as we did in Operation Overlord, we reignite our United States of we band of sisters and brothers, seize the torch of Lady Liberty, and muster the guts to outvote Citizens United, temper climate change, and bring all our people home. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.